Good evening, this is John St. Germain welcoming you to the Crystal Silence League Radio Hour for tonight. And we'll have a joyous celebration in the chat room. Everybody's saying the sound is good this week. A sad but also sort of a joyous program as we remember our friend Ron Martin Shank, who was a psychic, a root worker, a friend to many, and a mentor to many of us. Ron passed away December 31st, 2015, and many of us were very sad to lose a good friend, but we know that he has passed on in spirit. Those of us in the Crystal Silence League know that as you pass into the silence, you join the divine mind, the cosmic inner web of thoughts of everyone who has come and everyone who will be. So we shall come back in just a few minutes. We'll have a brief musical interlude. Grab your crystal balls. Grab a warm or cold drink of your choice, a loved one, your cat, your dog, your iguana, your significant other, and do join us in just a few minutes. And I'm back, John St. Germain, and this is the Crystal Silence League Hour. For those of you who don't know or haven't listened to our show before, the Crystal Silence League was founded around 1917 by Claude Alexander Conlin for the purpose of sending and distributing prayer and positive affirmation for those in need of such. And when Mr. Conlin passed into the silence around 1954, the league went with him. Although we have heard from people who continued practicing crystal projection in the years in the interim, and some people have sent me copies of their membership card that they continued to carry through the interim. But the league itself was gone with Mr. Conlin until around 2009 or 2011, sometime in that realm, when adepts of the Missionary Independent Spiritual Church founded it again in cyberspace, and you can find us on www.crystalsilenceleague.org, where you can post prayers. In Mr. Conlin's day, people used to send prayers to him on postcards, and he would have great mounds of these that he would pray over. He would lay his crystal ball upon these great mounds of postcards and pray over them. The pastors of the Crystal Silence League pray three times a day. We send crystal projections of thoughts to you three times a day via crystal ball, and members of the Crystal Silence League, of course, receive these via crystal ball. And we have a couple of books written by our founder, Mr. Conlin, that you can buy for $5, and you can also buy crystal balls from us and also from our sponsor, Lucky Mojo Curio Company, and learned the secrets of crystal ball projection and reception. Also, there's a newsletter you can subscribe to for free, edited by me, John St. Germain, your humble servant. And there's some very good information there that comes out every month. This month, it'll go out in a few days. There's articles on dealing with Mercury retrogrades and how crystals can help you with that. Our crystal of the month today is an appropriate one. We're going to talk about Apache tears. And Apache tears are small balls, regularly shaped lumps of black obsidian, which is volcanic glass. And legend says that Apache tears were formed when a group of 50 Apache braves were in battle with U.S. cavalry troops, and rather than face defeat, they drove their horses over a cliff and perished. And when the women heard of this, they cried. And when their tears fell off the cliff, they turned into these black stones when they hit the ground. which symbolize grief. The more mundane explanation for Apache tears is that lava is spewed into the air, and obsidian, of course, is a black, usually black. It comes in all different colors, but usually black volcanic glass. And Apache tears are formed when this glass is spewed into the air and hardens in the air in tiny droplets and then patters upon the ground. It's usually found around Mexico and southwest U.S. So there are these tiny little balls of glass. Now, there are some forms in Hawaii called Pele's tears, which are more teardrop shape, and they're usually found with Pele's hair as well, which is these extruded hair-like strands of glass, which are very, very thin and very strange looking, but that's another story. So Apache tears are carried to help you get past grief. When you have trouble letting go of grief, Apache tears help you deal with the grief and catalyze it and let it go. So I'll tell you that I have a bracelet that is Mercury Dimes and Apache tears, and I wear this a lot. When you reach a certain age, usually around 50 and above, you start hearing more about funerals and deaths and sicknesses than you do about births and weddings. And when you reach that age, it's good to have something nearby that you can wear, and this is my bracelet, when you start letting go of friends. So that is our Stone of the Week, Apache Tears. Crystal Silence League gets many hundreds of prayers a week posted, and you can go there to post a prayer. Prayer is always free at the Crystal Silence League, and you can read these prayers. And when you do, you can click on a button, and the button sends an email to the person posting the prayer, letting them know that you prayed for them. And it's been my custom to print some of these prayers out, and we read them on the air. And if you like, you can join us in prayer, and you can also project with your crystal balls if you know how to do the projections. And so we never read these by name. I only use prayer ID, the prayer number ID. And so it's that time now. We're going to do some of these. So we shall read these out loud now. And if you'll join me, that would be very nice. So the first one is prayer ID number 46586. And this is a court case. This woman wants us to pray for her son, who is mentally ill, and he's going to court, and they're trying to negotiate a deal. Apparently he's in trouble, and he apparently went to jail because the state mental hospital was full. It seems like a terrible deal, and she wants us to pray that he gets a fair shake and the lawyer gives him the best deal that he can. He's on his meds and doing well, so let's pray for this young man to get a good deal in court. Prayer ID number 46585. Wants us to pray for his mother, who lost her job unfairly 6 months ago and has not been able to find employment. So he wants us to help her get a job. Prayer ID number 46584 needs that when he or she works the night shift, that it's very strange, but it says apparently her client likes to buy gifts off her wish list when she's working a night shift. So I don't know what job that is, but I hope her clients buy her nice gifts on her night shift. Prayer ID number 46583 prays that her new love, her boyfriend, that this new love that she's kindling works out, and this be the one true love that for her that works out. Prayer ID number 46582 wants reconciliation between her and her husband. Prayer ID number 46581 also needs reconciliation in their marriage. They're currently separated. Prayer ID number 46580 needs help from angels and guides to be guided to the right job so she can become financially independent. And prayer ID number 46573 needs peace of mind and body. Prayer ID number 46578 prays for a wonderful job to start the new year, positive changes in his life, in her life, and reconciliation and peace in her relationship. She wants a new start all around, good start for a good year. Prayer ID number 46577 is a disabled veteran with many injuries and needs for her injuries to get better. Prayer ID number, she has about six up here. Let's condense them. Prayer ID number 46574. Needs prayers that she'll pass her finals and graduate and to banish all negative energies from her environment. Prayer ID number 46573, peace, forgiveness, and gentleness between him and a woman whose initial is T, so that sincere love can blossom between them. Prayer ID number 46572, it's a court case, and he's protection of his company, which is apparently family-owned. Prayer ID number 46571 needs prayers for two very special people in his life. Prayer ID number 46570 needs healing for someone whose initials are M.A. to be completely healed of the leukemia in her blood. Prayer ID number 46569 needs prayer for herself because she's had a stroke. And prayer ID number 46567 prays desperately for protection for her family and for a friend named Michael, whose family also needs protection. May these prayers be answered. May those in comfort receive it. May those in need be healed. And let's take a moment of silence for all in need of comfort and prayer. Program this week is a special memorial program for a very special person, Ron Martin Shank, who was a root worker, a reader, an outrageous character, a very funny person, and a man who who positively affected pretty much everyone he ever met. I knew Ron for about 25 to 27 years. I guess I met him in the early 90s, maybe 30 years. Anyway, I became went from a young man to an old man in this wacky business, and Ron was a friend of mine all the way. We used to speak on an average about once a week, and Ron would call me up with some very strange ideas, and I would call him up for strange ideas. Ron called me about 2 months ago, for instance, and he said, John, he said, did you know that there is a psychosis, a mental disorder, where people will chew off the tips of their fingers? And I said, well, no, Ron, I didn't, but that's interesting. He said, yeah. He said, I just imagine people sitting in a little cell back in the old days, just quietly chewing their fingers, and just the way we used to talk. I said, well, Ron, I was going to have fried chicken for lunch, but now I think I'll have a cheese sandwich, but what got you involved in that? And he was researching more obscure psychiatric disorders so he could better understand people. And that's just the way Ron was. He, to the end of his life, he was learning new things, and he was very excited about a strange deck of cards I found. And I told him about it, that you could do readings with, and he was on his way to get him a deck. That was a week before he died. Last time I spoke with him, he was excited about getting a deck of cards. And so, if you're interested, if you're friends of Ron, if you're listening to the show, I would like you to call the show, and the call-ins for guests is 657-383-0525, and press 1. And when you press 1, I'll pick up the phone, and you can tell your own memories and anecdotes about Ron Martin Shank. I certainly have plenty of them, and what we're going to do is play some excerpts of an interview when Ron was on my show back in April of last year, and we were discussing a book and workshops that he gave called Wake Up, which was a book and a workshop that he taught in his hometown of Virginia, in Virginia. He lived near the D.C. area. It was Reston, Virginia, and where he mostly worked all of his life. Once he got out of the military, Ron was a member of military intelligence, and there are some interesting stories about that, in fact. But let's listen to some of the interview from April of 2015. I was looking through your book, and it's very interesting. So your contention in this book, and it's one I agree with, is that most of us walk around half asleep, or even fully asleep.
Yes.
Yeah. So you describe three steps, and so tell us what's your premise here? What do you mean when you say we're not awake?
Well, it's one of those difficult things to talk to people about is mental states. English doesn't have an awful lot of words like some languages do to describe our inner states. And sure enough, I realized just myself years and years ago that, well, let's imagine that you're driving from your house to your job, as you do most days of the week, and as you're driving along, all of a sudden it dawns on you that you don't remember that last intersection that you go through every day. You have no memories of the fact that you went through it. You must have, because you're beyond it, but it's not there in your memory. You know, did you run someone over? Was there traffic at that intersection? You have no memories of it. And it's rather kind of scary to think about that. And to my mind, I had started investigating what was that all about. And it's sure enough, it does seem to turn out that there's a certain percentage of our day that we're just not there at all. I mean, just barely anyway, minimally. And it's, well, we all know about sleep. We do that at night. We close our eyes, and mostly our consciousness is gone. Sometimes we dream. Sometimes we don't. And it's a passive state. Not very much information gets into us at all. And it's a state we all know about. So it was fun to discuss that because we're familiar with it. And then there's the next step. Let's imagine it is a series of steps, like up the stairs maybe. That second step then is awake. Somewhere between sleep and awake, there's this threshold, and all of a sudden, our eyes are open, and we hear the birds chirp outside, and we smell the coffee, and there we are. And now it's no longer such a passive state. Now we can actually take some action, and now a higher level of information is coming into us, and we can process it and use it. And one of the insights, I think, is that the difference between those two states is a huge step. I mean, it's the difference between living your life and being in a coma for the rest of your life. It's almost the difference between life and death in a way. It is then said, and I fully agree, that with some practice, you can stay more awake. Just like with sleep, sometimes there's deep sleep where you can't hardly be aroused. If someone hollers and screams and shakes your shoulder, it takes you a minute. And then again, there's those times like a new parent where the baby cries and instantly you're awake.
Oh yeah.
When you're awake during, when you're awake during the day, there are also degrees of it. Sometimes you're half paying attention, you're kind of partly there, in semi daydreaming. But then again, there are those moments when the beautiful sunset just happens, and you look at it, and wow, there you are, and you're suddenly aware that you're there, and you're totally focused on your surroundings, what's going on, and that's certainly more conscious than you were back there in that daydream, stare out the window state. And if you continue, let's imagine that that's not a series of steps. Let's say it's a ramp going up slowly from sleep up a bit and then to awake. And let's imagine that then there's a third step up there beyond that. It's different between sleep and awake, as the first two are, and it's an increase in that awareness, that consciousness, if you will. It's less passive. There's even more information available, and we're even more aware of who we are and where we are and what's around us and what's happening, and it gives us a tremendous advantage in being able to react, to process more information, to make better choices, and it's, I just call it that third step of consciousness, and it can be gained through practice, through meditation, mindfulness meditation, if you want to call it that, I guess many have. Mm-hmm. And that was the workshop we were working on when this some years back in a public park here in Virginia, when a woman sat down and took notes on the things that I said, and bless her soul, she went home and typed this all out. It must have taken her days. And as it turns out, I learned the story many, many years later. She remained anonymous initially. She just kind of mailed it to me, and there it was. And she didn't say who she was or why. And as it turns out, in the long run, she had a very jealous husband. And she didn't want him to know she was doing this because he'd get jealous and think there was something going on between us, I guess.
And we're back. This is John St. Germain. That was part one of our interview with Ron Martin Shank, talking about his book, Waking Up. And it was interesting. Ron was telling a story about a woman who he was afraid the husband might think something was between them, because that seemed to happen a lot with Ron. He liked the ladies, and mostly it was very innocent, but sometimes they did become infatuated with him. Ron told me a story about a bag he carried. He carried a lot of bags, and he had this very mystical looking bag. And it was a very frayed and worn out looking bag. It was a black bag made of cotton, and it had a hemp rope around it. And people would ask him about that bag, and he had all kinds of stories about it. But what happened, he told me, he went out to dinner one night with his son and his daughter-in-law. And when he got out to the car, he noticed that he had forgotten to take the napkin from the table. He had tucked it down in the front of his pants so he wouldn't drop food on his pants. And he had forgotten to take the napkin out, and he was wearing a dark suit. And he just forgot, so he was out in the car, and they were driving around, and he noticed that the napkin from the table for the restaurant was still tucked down in his pants, and that's what he made the bag out of. He goes, well, this is really a nice napkin. It's made of cotton, and it's nice and black and sturdy. So he took it home, and he didn't even sew it together. He glued it together, fabric glue, and then he took sandpaper and roughed it up and frayed the edges on it and put a piece of hemp rope around the top, and he filled it with hoodoo goodies. He put bones in it for readings, and he put a voodoo doll, and he put healing oil and a few things like that in it. He carried it around, and it smelled funky because of all the things he put in it, and he added other scents and things in it. And when women would ask him about it, he would open it up and go, "Oh yes, smell it, smell it." He'd put it under their nose and have them inhale deeply. "Oh yes, smell it, smell it. Oh, doesn't it smell old and musty and weird?" And they would go, "Oh yes, yes." And then he would take all the stuff out of it, but he would open the bag up and say, "Here, smell, smell." And he'd put their nose right down in the bag to smell all this weird stuff in it. And one of the stories he told me was when he helped his son and his daughter-in-law, and apparently his son was very conservative, he went over to visit them. He helped them move in, and the neighbors came over, and he had one of his many bags with him, and they introduced him, and they go, "Yeah, this is my father, Ron." And he goes, "Oh, pleased to meet you." And they go, "Well, what's in that bag?" "Oh, well, let me show you some of the stuff." And there was a voodoo doll, and there was a book that he had found that was apparently the patient list from a Victorian era mental asylum, and he was showing, "Oh, and look, this person got a lobotomy, and this person was in for murdering his entire family. Don't you find this interesting?" And he was showing him the voodoo dolls and the chicken bones and possum bones and stuff, and his son was in the corner like going, "Ah." So Ron liked to say that he was a professional creepy old man, or a professional lovable creepy old man, and that was his job title, that he thought, and He also carried around magic tricks with him to show little kids, and they were always kind of funny, but also a little bit creepy too. And, you know, he had a clown nose, and it wasn't the SpongeBob clown nose, but it looked like a real nose that had been taken off of a clown, and you know, he would make it disappear and things. So that was some stories about Ron. And I'll tell you a few more here in a minute. We hope some folks will call in with a few of their own, because I've got enough to talk about all night about Ron. Let's listen to part two of Ron's interview. If you'd like to call in with stories of your own, our number is 657-383-0525. Call that number, press 1, and that will raise a little flag here, and I will be only too glad to bring you on the air, and you can tell your own anecdotes about Ron Martinshank. You talk about traumatic events being especially more vivid than, you know, say, dinner, you know, having lunch with a friend. You talk about traumatic states being more vivid.
Oh, heavens, yes. I remember this was some years back. If you remember, the people that have, say, just come home from overseas where there's bad things going on, there's war and shooting, and some of the military guys who had returned, they would say that although they it was a horrible experience in many ways, and they really didn't like it a lot, they realized that they were more alive in those moments than they were at other times. They were forced to be totally awake, because every sand dune, every wall, every window, every door could have someone behind it trying to shoot at them or kill them. And so, of course, your senses are totally alert, and you're super aware of everything. And that state became something that they were very, very conscious of. And they found it kind of almost addicting, that they wanted to be more conscious like that when they came back home over here, but found that without some sort of outside push, they couldn't do it as well. And sadly enough, though, it's those memories in that state that we remember the most.
Right.
And so for them, sometimes they're unpleasant memories, where I think the stress syndrome starts from.
Yeah, it's almost as if they were etched deeper than the casual memories, even the more pleasant memories. Do you think it's true that we remember bad events stronger? That bad events leave a deeper imprint on us than pleasant events?
Perhaps so, if you will. I think modern psychology is starting to realize that may somehow be true. That we pay more attention to threats than we do positive stuff, because it's a matter of survival. We hear a noise in the bushes, it's better to be on the safe side, to think it may be that saber-toothed tiger and be a little bit worried about it and pay more attention, than to just say, "Ah, heck, it's nothing." So they think perhaps we're wired just a bit to pay a little attention to stuff that seems a little bit of a threat, or a little bit worrying, a little bit possibly threatening.
Yeah, the fear, I guess fear and the survival instinct would trigger this hyper awareness, or this greater awareness.
It certainly can.
Yeah, I guess it would. And whereas if you're in you're having a very happy memory, you would tend to be more relaxed. But it seems like you could train yourself. You could nudge yourself and say, "Okay, remember this. Wake up. Remember this. This is good."
Surely. You don't need to jump out of a plane with a parachute in order to get excited enough to remember it. Certainly that's true.
Yeah, but I'll tell you that one of the strongest memories I have, it's so clear, it's like it's yesterday. And my son is 35 years old. I remember holding my son in one hand right after he was born and looking into his eyes like it was yesterday. I remember that like it was yesterday. That's as clear as it was yesterday. And that's one of the clearest memories I have, and it hasn't eroded a bit over 35 years.
Well, those high peak memories can be wonderful. I know women that can remember everything in their wedding, who said what, who ate what.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the weather, the time of day, all of that stuff. And it's sure enough, I can remember some very pleasant times. I, too, have a son, and I can remember when he was very young, he and I spent time together, how wonderful that was.
It is. I remember being aware, too, that I was aware. I said, "I'll never forget this. This is the best moment of my life." And I was aware of that, you know, hey, pay attention. I said,
"Well, you're not like everybody, though, John. You're not like everyone. A lot of people don't pay any attention and don't know." Heaven knows, you watch people walk down the street with their phone in front of their face, thumb printing and typing away to people, and bang, they walk into the side of the building or into the lamppost because they're not there. We used to laugh in the workshop and call people zombies, which was kind of...
And Blog Talk has kind of given us a little whack. That audio ended a little abruptly. Ron was talking about how people were zombies, and we talked about how people would go to art museums and take pictures of the artwork so they could go home and look at the pictures rather than look at the artwork in the art museum. And we thought it was kind of funny to vicarious live that way. Some people in chat asked about how to get Ron's book. These books were never published by... publishers, so you can't get them in bookstores. Ron used to publish these himself at home on his printer, and you bought them from Ron whenever you met him. He do these workshops occasionally out of the store he worked at in Virginia, and sometimes he'd go to conventions. In fact, I bought the way I met Ron. I bought a book he wrote on tarot card reading, and I was a young man. I was 27 or 28, I guess, and I studied this book with great intensity. It was a very good book on tarot reading, and I met Ron at a convention, and this is how we met. And I went over to him and I said, Mr. Martin, would you autograph this for me? And he said, sure, I would be glad to. He was so surprised that anybody would want his autograph, I think. And he opened the book to autograph it, and he leafed through it, and he saw that I had underlined and highlighted and made copious notes in the margin, which I do with books, and some people think that's a blasphemy, but I do. And I made lots of notes in the book, and he was stunned, and he just looked at me for a moment. He looked at the book. He goes, "Wow, you really read this?" Like, he thought people bought them, I guess, and put them on the shelf, but a lot of people do. But yes, I read it, and I've read it a lot over the years. And I remember he wrote a book on runes. It was like a little notebook on runes. And I heard about it, and by that time I'd written a few books, and I sent him my books, and I said, "Ron, I'd really like to see that book on runes you wrote a couple of years ago." He goes, "Oh, sure, I've got that somewhere." And he goes, I'd like to update it a little bit. I'll send you a copy." And so I waited, and occasionally I'd see Ron. I'd say, "Ron, I'd love to see that book on runes." "Oh, sure, I'd send it to you." And then about a year later, it arrived in the mail, and it said the Book of Runes for John Saint Germain, and on the back in the copy it said, "For years John Saint Germain has waited for a book on runes, but only a few books were available. Now this book will allow John Saint Germain." He had rewritten the ad copy on the back of the book. In other words, just for me, John Saint Germain will now be able to do runes for his clients. Fast, easy runes that John Saint Germain can use to win friends, seduce women, and make money at parties. He had rewritten the entire ad copy, and all through the book, now and again, he'd drop my name. He would say, "Imagine, for instance, John Saint Germain was in a situation between jobs, and he just went through the whole thing and put my name in it." And I could just see him chuckling, wondering if I'd notice that. And of course, I did. And this is just the kind of guy he was, and practical jokes and things like that. I know that he would set things up like that for a lot of people. Ron had a wicked sense of humor, and he was interested in a lot of things other than just psychic reading. He liked magic tricks, and he played the banjo, and he played the piano. And I remember at a convention, it surprised a lot of people who didn't know him, because he got a young lady, and he set her down on this out of tune piano in the lobby, and he played beautifully, and he was he played for her. It was like no one else was in the room. He put all of his attention on her, and he played this nice little soft jazz piece, and he gave all of his attention, and it was just a lovely moment. And it was just, how many sides were there to this man? There were plenty. Let's go to the next part of our interview, and Blog Talk willing, we will listen to it all. I think, awareness is a choice, isn't it?
It is. Sadly enough, a lot of people don't understand that, or they're not aware that awareness is a choice. So that's why people like me are out there to smack them a little bit and say, hey, well, like you said about the man with the art, I can remember going to a concert in my younger years, and the Walkman was new in those days. And I can remember a couple of people in the concert in front of me with their Walkman on, listening to the cassette tapes of the people that were up on the stage while they were up on the stage. And I wanted to go up and pull them out of their ears and say, hey, it's right here.
That
but
blows
I don't
my
know,
mind.
So, yeah, yeah.
This is being whacked. You know, you're talking about meditation. Some people think meditation is falling asleep, I guess. You know, you go to Zendo's, the Zen master walks around with a stick to hit people to wake them up because, you know, they go to sleep.
Yes.
Yeah, they fall asleep. So somebody will give you a good whack with a stick just to wake you up, because a lot of times in meditation, people will fall asleep and they mistake it for enlightenment. People will say, yeah, I started meditating at 3:15, and then I blinked my eyes, and it was 4:25. Did I enter the Flurry? Did I enter Samadhi? No, you fell asleep. That happened to me when I was really young. I had a teacher, and I said I was looking at the clock, and half an hour just went by like that. He goes, you fell asleep. And
sure.
You get on the Buddhist forums, and people say, I think I've mastered entering Samadhi in the jhana because an hour just passed. And I think a lot of the out-of-body experiences of that, too. People fall asleep and dream that they've flown to the Himalayas or something, and then they come back and say, hey, I went out of my body. Yeah, and you were snoring really loudly while you did it, too.
Yes, indeed. Sure.
So I think that when I was taught meditation, I was told that you cultivated an attitude of joyous expectation, joyous awareness, alertness, joyous alertness, like you were listening for something to happen and watching for something to happen. Do you find that that's what you talk about being an active participation, active awareness? Do you find that's similar to what
you're
talking
about?
That's
a very good sentiment to have it said exactly that way. You were speaking of the going to sleep. They had a get-together on the West Coast. This was, God, years ago in the 70s. They had some high-ranking, there were six of them, gentlemen came over from Japan who were Zen masters, or so they said, and they were doing sitting meditation. And at least two of them fell asleep. And I was horrified. I mean, these are supposed to be, I thought, this is a con, this is a rip-off. But I soon realized that that's a very common thing. And yes, that man with that stick, the enlightenment stick, or although we used to have different names for it, they weren't so nice. If you felt yourself drifting off, and we all do that, God knows I do it, they would walk up, you would put your hands together in a, what looks like a prayer gesture to us, in front of your face, and you're in fact saying, please, would you give me a smack? And so he'll walk up behind you and whack, whack, one
yes,
on
sir,
each
may
of
I have
the
another.
Tops of your shoulders. Yes, and you're supposed to imagine that you're saying thank you to them. You kind of put your hands together, and then you can go back to meditation, because now you're there again. And it is a help, curiously. It really does help. And he's not trying to beat you black and blue. He's not doing it that way, but
it's just enough to bring you back to that moment. It's just really kind of a little tap.
It's very helpful. It really is very helpful, for sure.
Yeah, it brings you back into the moment.
Yeah,
because a lot of times you do in meditation, you'll tend to wool gather, you'll daydream, and
sure, absolutely,
that will bring you back into the moment. So you recommend meditation to help develop awareness and awakefulness.
Well, I say that to some extent that is my meditation is the sitting there and being aware of that moment. That is the meditation itself. As you said earlier, some people come and say, well, I want to learn to meditate because I'm so tense and I can't take drugs, and so I want to do that instead, because they see meditation as a tranquilizer,
right,
as a way to get stoned. And although you can sometimes have some secondary effects, such as being very relaxed and stress goes down, for sure, it's measurable, but that's not a goal. If you go into meditation saying, I'm going to be smart, I'm going to be super aware, I'm going to be better than everybody else, I'm going to be more hip, I'm going to be more... then you're wasting your time, because it's not a foot race to be run. Everyone sits there and you just are there to be there. It's difficult in our modern society to do that with our cell phones and our tablets. you know, in our cars, and it's difficult to sit and actually do nothing for just 10 minutes. Most people almost can't literally do it.
And we have a caller. I'm going to try to pick them up again. We seem to be having trouble with this, but let's see if we can do this. Hello, caller.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, this is Catherine.
Hey, Catherine. I tried to pick you up earlier, and we had trouble.
Yeah. Well, it's Mercury retrograde, and right now I'm in a car.
Yes. You're on the road, aren't you?
We're on the road. Sorry about that. We had hoped to, you know, be home, but there's traffic. Well, I'm just really glad that we're having this show about Ron, and people get to hear a little bit about his humor and about his ideas. You know, he was a guy who never stopped having new ideas. That's what you said, and it's so true. He really was. And I'd like to tell a little bit about Ron that I knew him too. He was a person who did readings, and you mentioned that he read from different stores over the course of his career, and he was a wonderful palm reader, and you have not mentioned that, but
right.
he could read people's palms, and as he got older, he couldn't see them from a distance. He got presbyopia, and he was getting to be a little elderly old guy with a silvery hair and a beautiful demeanor, but he could not read a person's palm without a magnifying glass. And so he got a beautiful magnifying glass, not just your any old magnifying glass. It was gorgeous. And he put it on a chain or a necklace around his neck, and he wore this fabulous outfit, and he had this magnifying glass, and it just sort of hung. He would wear like a vest, sometimes like different kinds of clothes. You wouldn't see that magnifying glass, and people would say, well, I'd like my palm read, and you'd give him your palm, and up would come the magnifying glass, and he would say, now, dear, and that's just so charming, because, you know, if he walked around with that magnifying glass hanging out, people would go, what the heck is that doing? But, you know, as soon as he was reading, you were there, but he'd have that magnifying glass, and I just loved him for his character and his perseverance, and he was really a good teacher too. He taught me a lot, and
taught me a lot.
And I'm also proud to say that toward the end of his life, he decided to take my class in hoodoo, and that was a trip because he knew half this stuff already and more. And in my book on bone reading, I mention him and his friend Larry Balkin. And they were bone readers, both of them, and I talk about their method of bone reading, which they use chicken bones. And Ron was always irreverent. He always had a funny word to say, and we were talking about bone reading because I was interviewing him for the book I was writing, and I said, well, tell me about where you get your bones. Because, you know, a lot of people will say, well, this bone came to me through a sacred shaman in Siberia, and this bone I got, you know, when a zoo decommissioned this lion skeleton. And he just laughed, and he goes, chicken bones? You can get them at the KFC. And I just, that was Ron all the way. Nothing, you know, he could make do with anything, and he was really good at what he did. He really was the best, and there's never going to be another one like him.
Oh, no, he was one of a kind.
Oh, he was. He really was. And I miss him a lot. I used to talk to him often on the phone, and I would always tell people, you know, if you're down there, go look him up and get a reading. As he got older, his health declined. But, you know, he was always willing to be there to help people and serve people, to teach them what he knew. And he was also a big inspiration, I know, to a lot of people because, as you mentioned, he did magic tricks.
Yes.
And when I was a kid, I used to like to do magic tricks too. But I wasn't ever really good at it, but I loved to do it. And Ron and I were talking one day, and he goes, tell me what your favorite magic trick was that you did. And I told him it was one of those little tricks, you know, you buy them at the magic store. And you learn how to do it. And I told him that. He goes, I have that one too. And then he began to rattle off the magic tricks that he had bought from the time he was about 10 years old. He remembered every trick he had ever bought He remembered where he'd got them. And the man was phenomenal. And he hit upon another one that I had had. And then he said to me, "Do you still have a copy of that one?" And I said, "No, I don't. It was a card trick." And I said, "No, I don't have that anymore." He said, "Damn," he goes, "I wish you had it because I want that one back. I used to have it too." And he really had a love of pleasing people with magic tricks. He was very good at it. Very good at it.
He was good at it. He would do magic tricks with readings. I don't mean, you know, to scam people, but you know, he would do a reading for people. He would say, "Would you like to see a trick?" And then, you know, he'd bring out a sponge ball and make it disappear, you know, and, you know, do a coin trick or something.
And
yeah.
I'll tell you another one. He told me sometimes when people come in for a reading, he would say some people are afraid. They're afraid to talk to the reader. And he gave me an example. He said, you know, the woman whose husband she thinks is cheating, and now she's here with the reader, and the reader is a man, and so she's afraid to talk about men who cheat, and yet she needs to talk about it, and he could tell what was on her mind. And he would say things like, "Well, let's get ourselves settled, and we'll settle down." And then he'd open up, like you mentioned, he carried little bags. He also had boxes. And he'd open up a little box, and he'd say, "Look at this." And he'd, you know, do something so simple and so fun, like, you know, pull a coin out of somebody's ear or some little trick like that. And he said the lady would relax. He goes, "You know, even a middle-aged lady whose husband is cheating and maybe leaving her, you know, it makes her smile when someone pulls a coin out of her ear." And I said,
"Well, and it makes him less scary."
Right. He said, "I'm not scary then." And I thought, I could never do that in a million years. But he had a way about him. And you can hear that in these interview clips, his laughter. He's had a very, very sweet laugh, and he was so pleasing to people. And he also knew his history. I don't think there was a reader he didn't know about. He knew them all, and he learned from so many people that are gone now. And he taught me a lot of, you know, the history of it all, who he had worked with, who he knew. It was a real who's who, I'll tell you.
It sure was. And, you know, his parents were advocates of Camp Chesterfield. When he was a child, they took him and his sister a lot to Camp Chesterfield. So he grew up, that was the big spirit camp.
He was right. It was a spiritualist camp. And he learned to be a spiritualist medium, and his family were spiritualists, and he was like me. I had learned this before I met him, but it was a surprise to me to meet someone else who I could talk about it with. He, like me, had this gift. It's an unusual gift to be able to read objects. I don't know. Can you do that, John?
Oh, psychometry.
You know what I'm talking about?
Psychometry.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he had that ability, too, that if someone would bring you, say, the ring that belonged to their deceased cousin or anything like that, I can read them, and he could, too. And I hadn't met too many people who can do that, and we were talking about it, and I said, you know, where did you learn how to do that? And he told me that he had learned that it was possible by going to a spiritualist lecture, and he had no idea that such a thing existed. And he thought, well, there must be some trick to it. You know, there must be some technique. And he went up to the spiritualist medium after the demonstration. And he said, how do you do that? And the guy said, well, you just close your eyes for a minute, hold the thing, open your eyes, and there you know what it is. And he goes, oh, that's impossible. And he was quite young at the time. He decided he'd give it a try. And it worked. He said it worked.
Yeah.
If it hadn't worked, he wouldn't have been a psychometrist. And he said, that's the one thing you cannot teach people, how to do that. Either you have it or you don't. And he had it. He was fascinated that I had it. I was fascinated that he had it because not too many people can do it. He said he could pick up a watch. He could pick up anything from the dead or the living, and he could read it. And, you know, there's been a couple of books written about psychometry back in the New Thought era. You know, William Walker Atkinson wrote a book about it. Ron told me, he goes, I went and I got his book thinking maybe I'd learn more about it. But he goes, it was just the same stuff I already did. And he goes, all you have to do is just, he said, just tell a child that it's possible to do it, and the one child out of 1,000 or 10,000 that can do it will be able to, and the others will not. They won't. There's no trick to it. It's just you either do it or you don't. And so we were the small band of psychometrists who particularly could read artifacts of the dead. That was what he did, and he was so honest about it. Because I said, "Why don't you write a book about it?" He goes, "There's nothing to write."
There really isn't.
So,
you taste it. What I tell people, I say, taste it.
Mm-hmm.
Try to find the flavor of the object. Taste it. And
yeah, exactly. So. Well, those are some of my memories of Ron, and I'll tell you, he was something. And I know that the Tarot book you mentioned, that's also good, but it's funny because here we are talking about this, and the truth is those were privately published really for his students, for the workshops he gave.
Right. Mm-hmm.
He did not seek fame, and I asked him... No, many times I said to him, why don't you join AIR? You know, we got this beautiful directory of ethical and honest readers, people who are good practitioners, who are helpers. Why don't you join? And you know what he said to me? He goes, oh, I might have to work too hard if I join them. And I said, well, you know, I said, you're getting old. You could read on the phone and you wouldn't have to get up and go down to the shop and do readings there. And he goes, well, if I didn't go down to the shop, I just get too tired and sit here. If I sit on the phone, he goes, I might get sicker than I am. And
oh, my goodness.
And so he said, yeah, so I said, oh, come on, but you could, you know, you wouldn't have to work so hard. You could read on the phone. He goes, no. He goes, I'm going to read till I can't read anymore. So I never did get him to join AIR, which was a disappointment to me because...
Catherine, I'm going to extend the show. I'm going to extend the show to 90 minutes.
Okay, sure.
Would you like me to do that?
Yeah. Sure, yeah. That would be great.
Okay.
He is a person who will not be forgotten by those who knew him. And all my attempts to get him to be in AIR... you know, went south because he just was, he was busy doing what he did. Now, he worked at a shop down there, and I've forgotten the name of it. Do you remember? Oh, was it called Eclectica? Was that the name
Eclectica,
of it?
Eclectica, and he was also, at the time he passed away, was working at a place called the Owl's Nest, and they're having a memorial for him on the 24th in the shop.
Oh, good. Oh, good. Yeah, the Owl's Nest, that's right. First Eclectica, then he was at the Owl's Nest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was one of their readers, and he was just I don't know, he taught people. I read a beautiful little memorial to him online from one of the readers there, a younger woman, and she had been taught by him. He also at one point, again this is just going back into Ron's past, and he lived a long life and had many different things happen in his past. At one point he had started a church, a spiritualist church, and I think it kind of, he was married at the time, and I think it kind of, when the marriage ended, that was the end of that. But he was a minister. I don't know if you know
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have a picture I put up of him in his robe.
Oh my gosh.
On the slideshow, there's a picture of him when he in his robe.
Oh, yes. Oh my gosh. I'm just looking at it right now. I just made it back home from the road. I walked up on the phone the whole time. Yep, and there's a nice picture of him there with holy water and with all of his little goodies and making things. He really...
there's also a picture of him reading palms with his magnifying glass, squinting through the
magnifying glass. That's
so
right.
You can
that's
see...
Yeah, that's there. It's right there. And, you know, something else, too, about his... root work. He was very clever and skilled with his hands, and he could make things, you know, little bags and dolls, and he could sew. This is a part of root work that a lot of people don't consider, but he knew how to make things out of, for people, mojo bags and all. And I'm looking at that photo. What's on that photo? He's got Hoyt's cologne. He's got all the old traditionals. I mean, that guy was a real old-fashioned worker. And he's got his little herbs and things like that. And that's the way he worked, just old-fashioned way. You couldn't ask for a better root worker either.
He wrote a lot of little private manuscripts on root work tricks and twists. He taught a class in that little shop, and he had little handouts and stuff. But he also, I guess they were just little private notes. He sent me a number of them that were just little, guidelines with some of his thoughts, tricks, like working with nails. There's a little thing he wrote on working with nails and things on house cleaning. And I asked his permission if I could include some of the house cleaning stuff in that little book that I have on hexes that I give to people, helping mm-hmm. hexes. He goes, oh, sure, go right ahead. And I had to edit it some because he loves complex compound sentences. So I had to bring it down a little bit. But I have a whole chapter in that book on hexes that says with Ron Martin Shank on clean, wow. Helping cleaning your house, cleansing your house. And he goes, oh, sure. He goes,
one of my favorite photos is not in this slideshow, and I think it's somewhere in my pile of electrons, is a picture of him at a cemetery. When he became my student, he had to go collect graveyard dirt because that's one of the assignments.
Yes.
And he went to a cemetery and he said he wanted to document it. And so I got the dirt in a little bag and then this photo of him standing there like an explorer by this big cross, a graveyard marker. And it was just funny. It was like he was like, yes, I was here. It was a trip. What a guy. Not too many people who send in the graveyard dirt think to document it. Like he looked like he just climbed Mount Everest or something.
Oh yeah, it was an adventure to him. He loved it. I used to send him pictures mm-hmm. of some of my candle setups, and he would say, oh, you know what you could do, he'd say, those are great. You know what you can do, and he'd have a. It was an adventure to him. He was always so enthusiastic, too. You'd call him up. I'd give him a call. I go, Ron, it's John. He'd go, oh, John, hey, how are you doing? Hey, it's great to hear from you. It's like I hadn't talked to him last week, he hadn't heard from me in 2 years. Oh, hey, it's great to hear. How's it going? What's going on? It's great to hear from you.
Yeah.
He was always so glad, so enthusiastic and happy. When you talked to Ron, you just got this feeling that you were taking life too seriously.
He was a really an upbeat person, and he did struggle with health issues. We don't want to lie about that. He had COPD, mm-hmm. chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. In other words, he'd smoked when he was young, and it's what used to be when I was young. They call that emphysema, but now emphysema is one of the COPD syndromes. But anyway, he had that, and it tired him out, but he kept going. He did not let that define his life. He really kept going. And
the last time I saw him in person, he'd gone over to vaping. He quit smoking and was vaping. And
yeah, right.
Like that's
sure.
Better,
Well, maybe it extended his life a little bit. But I tell you that, the age he was, and like you said, he was in the military, and that was what people did. They smoked.
Yeah.
And they all got addicted, and it was not good for his health. But But he also, I think he felt at that point he was just going to carry on with what he did, and that's who he was going to be, But I'm glad to hear he was vaping at the end of his life there. That's funny.
It seemed to help him a little bit. I think it helped him a little.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure it's that much better for you, but...
No, I don't know that for sure. I'll tell you another one, a little more funny one, then we should play another clip or something, but I just want to tell you another funny thing about him. When I was talking to him on the phone, we would talk fairly regular, and usually my husband, Nagashiva, is always around, whatever, and we were talking, and usually I'd say, well, Naga Shiva is there in the room or whatever, but I hadn't mentioned Naga Shiva. He goes, is your husband still with you? And I said, yeah. He goes, okay, just checking. And it cracked me up. It was just like, whoa. I said, yeah, we're fine. He goes, okay, just checking.
Oh,
I don't know. He had a sense of humor. You'd have to have been there, but it was just, he was good.
The lady he knew who ran the burlesque club, he did a number of, he used to hang out at the burlesque club. He did readings at the burlesque club, and he helped her with costume design and with routines, with suggestions. And he said, oh, sure, I'll be your professional dirty old man. And he'd sit in the front row and be cheer him on and stuff. But the way he met her, apparently she also worked at the owl shop as a clerk or something. And he walked in the shop, and she was on a stepladder. And he said, oh, you're wearing my favorite kind of jeans. She said, what, guess? He goes, no, tight.
Oh, yeah. He was
and from him, that
way.
Was charming. From me, I'd get something dropped on my head. But from him, that was charming. He could do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, he had a way. He was totally non-threatening. And like I say, like you said, he played the dirty old man, but he just did it to break the ice, really. He did never. But I can imagine him helping burlesque gals because he did know a lot about costuming. He knew a lot about stage presentation. And he knew a lot about lecturing. He was a very good lecturer. He really had done that a lot, been on a platform and lectured, and he was good at giving those workshops. And he would tell me about the workshops he gave too, workshops in meditation, workshops in, tarot and things like that. You could just basically go up to him and say, teach me anything, and he'd say, okay, what do you want to know? And he'd be ready to roll. He knew it all. And I look at these people. I'm going to just digress here for a minute. These folks come to me and they say, I'm making products and I'm going to be a reader. And I say, well, have you ever had readings done for you before? Oh, no, I do my own readings.
Mm.
Well, that's a person who doesn't understand the history of this work or how it's transmitted.
Right.
And
right.
Ron would go to other readers for readings,
yes.
too.
Mm-hmm.
And he would drop in. He would, like me, when I was young, he would work at the psychic fairs. And you've worked at psychic fairs too, right?
Oh, yes, yes. I was with the circuit for many years.
Yeah. So with these psychic fairs, a lot of people, again, I'm just going to put this into the show because there's going to be people listening to this who have no idea what we're talking about. But these psychic fairs were real big. They still are, but not like they were. It was a big deal. And there would be readers, all kinds of readers. Different psychic fairs were run different. Sometimes you'd go in and you'd buy tickets, like going to a carnival, and you'd get so many tickets, you get so many readings. Or there would be a person with an appointment book, and they would schedule you for readings at different times. Or sometimes if they were kind of a more slapdash psychic fair, you'd go in and you'd just go to the reader you wanted and you'd pay on the spot. And he had worked at all of these types of fairs. And he became fascinated, as he put it, by the bad readers at these psychic fairs.
Mm-hmm.
And he would go, he'd go and get readings from the bad readers, the ones that no one was going to because they were sloppy and they looked stupid and they had dumb books on their table. They'd be sitting there reading some harlequin romance waiting for
it.
And he'd go in and he would actually, on his own dime, on his own time, he'd pay for a reading. And he was telling me, this woman, she was reading a harlequin romance and she's sitting there and he said she was, she had nothing on her table, nothing pretty. And he had stuff on his table. He always had something, flowers or a crystal ball, something to attract attention. He said he took his vase of flowers and he went over to her and he goes, do you mind if I bring you these flowers, ma'am? And she goes, what? And he goes, are you here to do readings, ma'am? And she goes, yeah. And he goes, is that book really fascinating? What is it? And she goes, oh, I'm just reading my romance. And he goes, would it be all right if you gave me a read? And he basically walked her through, $500 course in how to be a reader at a psychic fair, but just so gentle. He laughed about it after. He said he didn't know if she took all the lesson, but he said, I walked away and she had flowers on her table anyway, and I told her to put the book under the table and look alert.
You know, he told me a story about how he learned about that. He said right when he got out of the military, and he said he was cynical and jaded, you know, from the military and stuff, but he went to a lot of parties, and he said, you know, he could do some tarot readings and stuff, but he used to carry a deck in his pocket, but he said there was a, you know, like a hippie chick at a party, and she had a big tote bag with her, and she mentioned that she was just learning to do tarot readings, and everybody was really interested, and so she went to a table, and in her tote bag, she produced scarves and put it on a table, candles and lit them in a crystal ball, and she spent 20 minutes setting up that table. And then she did tarot readings, and Ron said the readings were not good. They were basically the, you know, the little book you get with a tarot deck, you know, that little instruction sheet.
The little
they were
white
just
book.
That.
Yeah,
they were just that, and they weren't that good. But people were fascinated with her, and he said it was because she took the time to make a setting, and she took it so seriously. You know, lighting the candles, and she burned incense, and she put a crystal ball, and she said, I'm ready now, and because of the setting. He said it was the theatrical setting, and he said he learned something there about the theatrics and the setting, and that he said that changed the course of how he looked at readings, that you had to have a theatrical setting, and that's true, and that I took away from that. He told me about that when we were first when I first met him, and when I went to psychic fairs, man, I had stuff on my table. And I would sit at the table and do those Chinese exercise balls in both hands, like David Bowie did in Labyrinth, you know.
Right.
And people would walk by and they would go, "Hey," you know. And I would always make eye contact. They'd come by and I would smile and make eye contact, and I would do those Chinese balls in my hand. And I always had really pretty stuff on my table, and I had a very decorated table. There was no room to do anything. I did palm reading. I didn't have to lay cards out, so there was no room on my table. I had crystals and all kinds of stuff on that table, and that was from Ron. Ron told me that story, and I said, really? And I could see the truth in that, that there had to be a theatrical setting, and there were people that just sit there at a table with their business cards and their deck of cards in their hand, and people would just go by and look at them and go, huh, okay.
You know, another thing he told me, too, and I left it out of that story, but that's another thing he said. The lady who he gave her the flowers in a vase, she had her cards in the box they came from the printer. In other words, whether they were Rider Waite or whether they were Llewellyn Beck, they were in a box, and the box was all worn. And he said, never, never show your cards in an old, worn box. You need a bag. A tarot card bag or a box to put them in. He said people don't want to, you know, when you serve people at table, you know, you don't bring them the bags that the food came in. They're in a box or they're in a bag.
Yeah, it's very important. And your card represents you, so it should be presented professionally and with as something important.
Right.
So it's these little things make a difference. And Ron was big on smell, too. He used to put potpourri and scent in his the box his tarot cards was in. So when he opened the box, this waft of aroma would come
out. That's
right. And,
right. Thank you for mentioning that. That is absolutely right. Open the box, and the scent would waft out. And he used different scents for different days.
He was always looking for different scents. He wanted this stuff that smelled like an Egyptian tomb or something that would be
archaic. I remember
archaic.
That.
Yeah.
Right. He wanted something.
I learned that, too. I put sachet powder on my cards. I shuffle them into the deck. So when I shuffle the cards, the scent of the sachet scent comes from the cards. I use Uncrossing or Psychic Vision sachet powder. When I shuffle the cards, the scent will come from them. I learned that from him.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. You know, it's so funny because you and I haven't talked about this or rehearsed this at all. But he was so important in these little things that just mean so much in being a professional reader. And I'm telling you, who's left to carry on? I mean, I'm being a little sentimental here, but we ought to get together maybe and just, you know.
There's not that many. This is old school stuff, and it's not – you know, I see these people on Facebook who've been in it for 90 minutes, and they're saying, yeah, I'm going to do readings, but, you know, and then they say it's not important to study it, that, you know, they just use intuition, which means they just make shit up and throw it out there. But
yeah.
Shotgun readings,
yeah.
The old people used to call that shotgun readings. You throw it out there and hope some of it hits. And
right.
Some of the old guys aren't out there anymore. And, you know, every day another one passes away, and I just think, who's going to carry it on? I don't know. I just don't know.
No, it is an art. It really is an art. And he had it. And the nice thing about Ron, too, was he learned from everybody. I taught him a couple of things, and he taught me 100 things. But
yeah,
he was always grateful to what he learned from me. And, you know, he'd say, well, I never thought of that before, whatever it might be, you know. And we were talking, in fact, I'm going to tell you what it was that I told him. We were talking about, he was going to give a workshop on being a reader, right? And he was
mm-hmm.
talking about how one of the ways, and I'm sure people who've heard me read, and maybe you too, one of the ways that you can start a reading is to find out what sign of the zodiac a person is. It gives you a kind of a little leg up. It sort of starts the reading. You don't read their sign, but knowing their sun sign kind of helps you focus about where you're going to go with the cards or the palmistry. You'll know what's of interest to them.
It's
according
a
jumping
to point.
Their sun. But yes, exactly. It's a induction is what I call it, an induction point. Some readers do it, some do not. Madame Lenormand would always, you know, find out something like what your birthday was, and people, I know other people who say, are you a blonde or a brunette, if they read on the phone. So you need some point. What I tell people is this: there are 7 billion people on Earth, and I got to know, you know, which Joanne Bradley you are, because there's a whole hell of a lot of Joanne Bradleys. Trust me, you know, I've read for more than one. And so you want to kind of have that moment of connection. So he and I were talking about this, and I was saying, well, I always used astrology. And
people listening
said, yeah,
to the
you
show
know,
are getting $500 worth of professional advice, you know.
They are getting $500 worth of professional advice. So I said that I always used astrology for that. And he said, yeah, that's a really good one. And I told him a little trick that I had done when I was young, and I mean 18 years old young, and I didn't know Ron Martin then. But I could not remember the signs of the zodiac start and stop dates. So I put my cards in a box, and on the inside of the lid of the box, I had printed out from Dell's Horoscope magazine the start mm-hmm. and stop dates of the signs of the zodiac. And I told him that, and I thought he was just going to laugh, because I was talking about how innocent and stupid I was when I was young. He goes, oh, no, but you can use that with the stones that go with which. And he started rattling off all these things. He was so far ahead of me. I mean, I couldn't believe the guy. He was like, he goes, you know, you can do numerology charts in there, and you can work out there, you know, because he was a math head, and I'm not. He could take a person's name and get their lucky numbers right off without writing them down, you know. Because you could put anything in there, and I was like, oh, you've already done that. I thought I was going to teach you a trick.
Oh,
but it is a good trick for a reader.
He's got memory
yeah.
things everywhere.
He was phenomenal. Now, he'd know. He could work out from people's birth dates. He could give them lucky numbers. And I'm sitting there with a pencil, man, and he was in his head. He could do that. So could his friend, Larry, also.
Yeah, Larry.
A
I spoke to Larry earlier.
Yeah, a math genius. And Larry really could. How is Larry doing? Is he?
Larry said his heart and mind are filled with memories of Ron. He said he still can't believe he's gone.
Yeah.
Because
they
had lunch several times a week.
Yeah, they were close. They were always close,
to
one another. Yeah. Well, so it goes. Thus past the best of us and the worst of us and all of us. We all go to the ground eventually, but I'm going to miss him. I really am. And if this little memorial gives anybody a memory of what Ron Martin was really like, and they're going to regret that they get a chance to meet him. But,
oh, gosh, I
know.
I treasure knowing him. I'm going to miss him, but I know I'll see him again someday.
Yeah. And you know, it's like when our good friends pass, their spirit is near us. You know, he's probably sitting there laughing right now at us and our sort of struggling around in these, you know, clay bodies trying to, you know, flap our little mouths. And he's like, oh, yeah, sure, you know.
Well, I think when my mom died, my mom had emphysema, and I remember when she died, I think, just think how happy she is to be out of that tired old body. And I think the same thing with Ron. He's breathing in spirit now.
Yeah.
How glad he must be to be out
hard.
Of that old body.
That was hard for him. It was very hard because he had been a very strong, vital man. And we all get old, but we don't like to die, you know. But in the end, it's better to get old and then to die young. And he was able to live a long life and raise.
Well, and he had fun. He was old. He got old. I mean, he's in his 70s when he passed away, and he had fun all the whole time. He, you know, every time I spoke with him, he was always off to do something. And he had friends, and he was teaching people, and he was learning from people. And, you know, heck, that's the way I want to go. You know, I hope when I'm 70 and 80 that I'm still curmudgeonly and crusty and, you know, interested in ladies and doing readings and, you know, having fun. He's an inspiration to me. He really was. I've been lucky to know some very talented and noble and high-minded people. We speak about that a lot on the show, about how important it is to have friends that are high-minded and noble and who you want to be like, you know, who you aspire to be like. And I've been very lucky to have a lot of friends that way. And Ron was certainly one of them.
Yeah, he was. And you know, then there comes that moment, you know, it's like when a parent passes and then you think, oh, my gosh, now we're left to carry on that memory, but somebody is going to be looking to us. And the one thing I take away from Ron is his generosity in teaching. You know, when I met him, I was already a professional. I was not egocentric. I didn't think I knew it all. But to meet him was like took my work to another level. And he was a person who really generous. He would, if you had a problem, if you had anything that you needed to know about or how to do it, he would show you how to do it. He was just the one, you know. And he taught me, I'm going to give you one more little thing he taught me. He worked in a lot of different stores as a reader. And he taught me in very quick mathematics how stores work with readers. Which stores are good for readers, which stores rip off their readers, and which stores promote their readers, and why. And why do people become readers in stores that where they're not really earning a living, and how are they kept on the hook kind of in the store? He had the math for it. He knew the percentages because, you know, when you read at a store, they give you a percentage of money, or they give you all the money but you pay a table fee. Do they give you a commission on the sales of products that you sell afterwards, or do you just say goodbye, thanks for the reading, and send them into the store, or do you walk them through the store and show this you could have and this you can have, and is there a commission? And he was completely, I mean, he knew every system, beneficial and those that were exploitational of the readers and of the shops, and how they worked. And he sat down with me and really gave me a business model for Lucky Mojo and for how to deal with the readers and how to be a reader in a shop. And I don't think he ever wrote a book about it, ever gave a workshop about it. He just gave me 50 years of experience. You know, here you go. Here's a two-hour lecture just for Cat Ironwood. And that generosity is the kind of thing I'll never forget because we set up
a lot of shops do rip. There was a shop here in town, the reader would get $20 out of 100.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, believe me, there are, and he had it all, you know, is the reader on an hourly wage plus the reading, or are they just expected to sit at a table and read a book quietly, you know? And he went through every system that he knew and how much you got if you had so much a day. You know what I mean? He was like, the guy was a genius. And as far as I know, he never wrote that down. I don't, you know, because I'd say to him halfway through all of it, I'd say, I'm taking notes, but you're going pretty fast. And he goes, yeah, but then da-da-da-da-da, you know. And I'm like, wow, why don't you do a book on that, Ron? He goes, well, who'd want a book on that? Well, I would, Ron. Well, I just told you, you don't need a book now.
Oh, my gosh.
So he taught
me
a
lot.
Yeah,
he would go off in these research projects on, like I said, he called me up and said, did you know that there's a mental disorder on people who chew the tips off their fingers? Why would you want to know that? Yep.
I know, I heard you say that. Yeah, that is totally right.
Why would you want to know that? But for him, it was, you know, he was working on something.
Yeah, right.
But,
Lord have
you know,
mercy.
For him, it,
yeah.
And he said there's a mental disorder where people are compelled to eat dirt. And I said, yeah, I've heard of that one. And but he was collecting these for some reason. And, you know, who knows where that was going to lead. But
well, you mentioned that he had a book. That is so bizarre. He had a book about which mental patients had received which treatments at some British.
It was a little book that he had found somewhere. It was the admissions or casebook of a mental asylum in Virginia.
It had
the patients and why they were admitted. It was like the sign-in book that he found and he carried it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, because it was strange, because it was weird, because he could find it useful some way. I mean,
it was interesting.
There's
something to talk about. You know, like, oh, look at this.
Oh,
isn't this interesting? And look,
that's
this patient was brought in, you know, for, you know, wanting to marry a goat or something. And because he sent me a picture for reasons of admission to mental asylums in the 19th century. And, you know, some of them were just ridiculous and that, I think that was linked to what he had. It's probably some kind of presentation or something, some conversation he was going to come up with.
Well, you know, what I wonder, too, he might have been interested in it because as a spiritualist medium, he and I talked about, he was interested in, you know, what he told me was this. He goes, you know, you go to a spiritualist medium demonstration and everyone wants to talk to Uncle Al or Aunt Jenny. Or maybe they want to talk to grandma. But whoever wants to talk to the guy who is locked up in Colney Hatch, you know? And he may have been working on contacting the spirits of the dead who were in the state. I know that sounds crazy, but that's the kind of thing he would have thought about. Because I know, as a spiritualist, he, and like many spiritualist mediums, you trust your intuition, you do as you are spirit-led, but there's also sometimes that moment where you succeed beyond your wildest imaginings. You go, oh, my God, I really did just tell this all, and it was exactly right. And he was still thrilled by that, when he could do it. So he might have been setting himself a test to, I don't know, that's just a guess. But what a strange fascination. And he did like the odd, the unusual, and the bizarre. That's for sure. Well, we all, you know, it's like me with my train set, you know. People go, how could she be a reader and have model trains? You know, actually, that's another lesson for Ron. All readers are real people, and we all have our interests, you know. There are readers with their cats and their puppy dogs, and there are readers who, you know, have their interest in charitable things, and Ron was a student of human nature.
Well, you know, he was in military intelligence, you know, top secret stuff, and he worked with some gruesome things occasionally, and I know he worked with psyops, he worked psychological operations, and he learned some you know, some hardcore stuff when it was naval intelligence. And
did you notice, John, in that little audio clip you gave of him where he was talking about being in wars and seeing bad things, did you feel, I felt, he was talking about his own life?
Yeah, I think,
and
yes,
and it was eerie because he was talking to you as if it was theoretical, but you could hear it in his voice. He was talking about something that you felt more vividly, and I'm like, I don't. He's describing something out of his own life.
Yeah, he
so,
was.
Yeah, he did.
Was.
He had his own secrets. You know, he some things that happened to him in the military, I'm sure. We could probably go back and find out if we got his military records, but I don't think he got through that unscathed. I think that came through in his voice when he was saying that to you.
He said when he got out of the military, just now and again he would say, I came out of the military bitter and cynical. You know, he'd say things like that, you know, that was kind of hyperbolic, but, you know, you don't come out of the military bitter and cynical by pushing papers around.
Right, that's right, yeah.
You know,
he never
when he got out in the 60s, he said he did a lot of drugs and smoked a lot of pot and screwed a lot of women. You know, he laughs those things off. You know, he shrugs those things off. But, you know, in a little synopsis like that, you get the Oliver Stone view, you know, the Oliver Stone version of it. But, you know, when you think about the real-life version of it, you know, that's a guy struggling to fit back in. And the way Ron fit back in, I think he felt his way back in by this role that he adopted of the genial psychic reader.
Yeah, I think that's true.
I think it could have gone either way. He could have gotten a gun and got on top of a building and started shooting, or he could have done it the way he did it.
Yeah, well, you know, I think you're right. He once said something to me, too, which was funny. We were just commiserating about getting old. I was telling him, that I used to be one of those glamour psychic readers when I was young, you know, that. But I couldn't do the glamour thing anymore. I was getting too old. And he goes, being an old man suits me. He goes, I'm blessed with some really white hair. I just had to laugh. But he did. He had very white. His hair was really white, right?
Yes, yeah, silvery white.
Silvery white. And so he never. You know, boy, he looked cool with that white hair. So that was. He goes, yeah, I was lucky. I had white hair.
Yeah, he would wear white clothes, too, when he did readings. He'd wear these white clothes, white suits and white vests and a silvery vest and things. He augmented it.
He looked like
an angelic presence.
Yeah.
Middle-aged suits me. I like middle-aged. I don't. It's hard to take a 20-year-old seriously if you're 55 years old and a 20-year-old is going to tell you about life. You know. I have nothing against you guys that are 20 years old and doing readings and stuff. But you know, what are you going to tell me? You know about the hard parts of.
Well, that is absolutely the truth. And I've been talking. People ask me about names and. I need to have a professional name. I said, get yourself a professional name that you can use for the rest of your life. You don't want to change your brand in the middle. And I give myself as an example. When I used to read at psychic fairs, when I was young, I'd read under the name of Miss Kitty, which was the name from Gunsmoke for this, prostitute dancer singer with a heart of gold, right? And my name was Catherine, and Catherine is Cat, and so everyone knew me as Cat, but I went on as Cat Miss Kitty. When I got to be about 30, I just didn't want to dress up as Miss Kitty anymore.
Well, sure.
I became Miss Cat instead, and I lost my Miss Kitty fans, you know, because Miss Kitty didn't exist anymore. And he and I would talk about stuff like that, and he'd say, "Well, that's why I'm just Ron Martin." You know, Martin was his middle name, and he
Martin
didn't want people to look at. Yeah, he didn't want people looking him up in the phone book. So at some places, sometimes he'd go as Ron Shank, and other places as Ron Martin. He once told me that way he could work for two stores that were in competition, and neither knew that he was the reader at the other store.
That's a good way to do it. Well, we have about a minute left to the show.
Yeah, I'll say goodbye. Thank you so much for letting me talk.
My goodness. Thanks for calling. It was... It's great hearing from you as usual, and you have wonderful memories of Ron, as I do. And Ron could have come in from the other side.
Yeah, he would have had more stories to tell. He
would have told us
all
a lot more.
He would have
told
the Ronchi stories.
Good night, Catherine. Thanks for calling in. Well, this has been the Crystal Silence League Hour. We have been... talking about Ron Martin Shank, who passed into the silence December 31st of 2016. Gone from this physical plane, but certainly not forgotten by any means by those who loved him and knew him. Next week we'll resume our series of Buddhist lectures. Join us then, and thanks to those of you for listening. Come back next week, and this is John St. Germain, the voice of the Crystal Silence League, bidding you good night.